The Mekong is Southeast Asia's most storied river. Its rich biodiversity, though, has been under threat for decades from things like overfishing and overpopulation. Environmentalists are now adding dams to that list. Towards the headwaters of the Mekong is Laos, one of the poorest nations in the world. It's now planning a series of dams to generate hydropower and income. But environmentalists and neighboring countries like Cambodia and Vietnam are crying foul. They say the dams might have a devastating impact on the Mekong Basin. Michael Sullivan reports.
Okay, it's 9 o'clock in the morning. I am out in the middle of the Mekong. Cambodia is on my left. Laos is on my right. And dead ahead, I'm looking at two, maybe three dolphins, Irrawaddy dolphins, who are frolicking in this pool that's just below the area called Sipandan. And that's basically where the Mekong splits into seven or eight different channels and then comes back together here. Now, about three-quarters of a mile up this channel up here, that's where they're going to put this proposed Don Sahong Dam. And that's the one environmentalists say if they do put it in, it's going to have a devastating impact on the fish population here and may mean the end of the dolphin population here as well.
We chug up the channel in question, past fishermen in tiny boats, to see the proposed Don Sahong site. It's a fast-moving section of water, maybe 50 yards wide, and my first thought is, what's the big deal? Why does damming just one channel of the river here scare so many people? Turns out it's the only one that works, for fish anyway.
The Hu Sahong Channel is the only channel that fish are able to migrate up and downstream on a year-round basis. Other channels all have obstacles, waterfalls or man-made structures that are catching fish.
That's Amy Trandum with the environmental group International Rivers. She worries not only about the fish, but the people who catch them, and so do they. Almost everyone here fishes for a living. One local who doesn't want to be named isn't optimistic.
We export the fish in this area every season. So if they have hydropower, then all the people, no more job, no more fishing.
You think there will be no more fish left after the dam is built?
Yeah, no more fishing after dam.
What would happen if you spoke out against the dam? If you told the government, we don't want the dam here, what would happen?
We have no against. If they do thing, they do, and then there we follow them.
You don't get to say no.
No, we cannot say no.
He makes a slashing gesture across his throat, a reminder that Laos is a one-party communist state that brooks no opposition. Peter Hawkins is the environmental manager for the Don Sahong project and one of the few people from that side willing to talk about it. He says the concerns of locals and the environmentalists are valid, but he also says they've been dealt with.
I'm confident that the mitigation measures we can employ here will allow fish to pass the barrier that we're going to create.
Hawkins says his company, MegaFirst, is building fish passageways around the proposed site. And if that doesn't solve the problem?
We have the opportunity, if we do not have 100% success rate in terms of passage, we can continue to improve those bypasses. So we see this as a work in progress.
There's another work in progress a few hundred miles upstream that environmentalists fear even more, the Sayaburi Dam, which the government says is about 30% completed. Unlike the Don Sahong, this one will block the entire river.
We do see that Laos has every right to develop on its own pathway and should not be controlled by outside people telling them what to do. Maybe in terms of the Mekong main stem, they have been listening to the wrong advisors.
That's Zheng Wang Ming, a dams and hydropower specialist for the World Wildlife Fund. He says the Sayaburi Dam is being built without any real knowledge of the downstream effects. Water, Ming says, punishes every mistake you make, especially when it comes to allowing fish to migrate up and down the river.
The effectiveness of such fish passage mechanisms is quite well proven for our European or, let's say, North American rivers. But in the Mekong, we don't have five fish species which we have to take care of. We have 70, maybe even more. And we have no clue about them.
International Rivers' Amy Trandum says fisheries experts estimate at least 43 species of fish are likely to go extinct because of the impact of the dam, including the Mekong giant catfish, the world's largest. The other problem is sedimentation, dirt, silt the river carries downstream to Cambodia and Vietnam. The Sayaburi, Trandum says, will have major food security implications as well.
By blocking sediment, where there's a lot of agricultural productivity and rice growing, these areas are going to suffer a lot because they're no longer getting the same nutrients And so this will have a significant impact.
Vietnam and Cambodia aren't happy about either dam. They want work on both suspended while further study is conducted about the long-term effects they may have. Laos has politely told both and everyone else, sorry, but we're going ahead. For NPR News, I'm Michael Sullivan.
A study published in the journal Nature Climate Change says the population of emperor penguins at Antarctica is in danger. Hal Caswell is a scientist emeritus at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He co-authored the report, and he joins us from Amsterdam. Welcome.
Thank you.
You've been studying the emperor penguin population in Antarctica. What's happening to them?
The emperor penguin is affected by changes in the sea ice conditions. The projection is that all of the colonies, there are 45 of them known around the circumference of Antarctica, all 45 of them by the end of the century are going to be declining quite rapidly.
We've all seen the wonderful pictures of the penguins sliding across the ice and diving into the water. Could you explain how the ice works for these creatures and why climate change might affect them?
Yes. So this species breeds in colonies on sea ice. They make this long march from the edge of the ocean to breed in the middle of the winter. So if there's too much sea ice, that trudge to bring food to the chicks gets longer and more energetically expensive for the penguins, and this cuts down on their breeding success. On the other hand, if there's too little sea ice, then the basis of the Antarctic food web is not as productive.
And it's your anticipation that the climate will change in such a way that the sea ice will shrink?
Yes.
The emperor penguin is actually on the list to be considered for protection under the U.S. Endangered Species Act. Would protected status help them?
Listing them as an endangered species would have several really positive effects. The biggest one is that it would provide more impetus to take action on reducing greenhouse gas emissions and slowing or halting climate change.
You mean the penguin might become a sort of poster child for correcting the direction in which the climate is going?
Yes, and identifying threats to charismatic species like the emperor penguin, like the polar bear, is not going to be enough, but documenting threats to species like this, along with the many other impacts of climate change, is an important contribution, and it's really something that the Endangered Species Act is quite appropriate for.
Hal Caswell is a professor at the University of Amsterdam. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to talk to you.
The idea that plants respond and even benefit from sound is a popular one that's prompted many studies. So if you read poetry to your tomatoes, can they hear you? It's a good question. What about the chewing of a hungry caterpillar? Well, that one we do know the answer to, and the answer is yes. This recording and the research showing that plants respond to it come from the University of Missouri. It's the first study to suggest that plants can recognize the sound of a predator through vibrations on their leaves. To explain how that conclusion was reached, we're joined by Heidi Apple. She and Rex Cocroft did this research. She's a senior research scientist in the College of Agriculture, Food, and Natural Resources at the University of Missouri. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
And how did you conduct this study with the leaves and the caterpillars?
Well, the first thing we had to do was record the kinds of vibrations that caterpillars make on leaves when they're feeding. And these vibrations are very subtle. You can't actually see them. The leaves are moving like 1/10,000th of an inch. But you can't record those very delicate movements with a cold laser. So we were able to play back those vibrations to the plants in the absence of the caterpillars, and then afterwards, challenge the plants with insects and measure their chemical response.
And the chemical response was different if they'd been exposed to these vibrations beforehand?
Yes, they made many more mustard oils, which are these insect repellents. And we also, in a second experiment, measured anthocyanins, which are things that give flowers their color, red wine its lovely hue, and provide the health benefits to chocolate. And those defenses, too, were increased in plants after attack if the plants had received the vibrations beforehand.
So what you're saying is that a plant that has experienced what sounded like the harassment of a caterpillar responds differently than an inexperienced plant.
That's correct. And in our second experiment, we really wanted to tackle the question, is this ability to detect the vibrations ever important? Because a plant, of course, is exposed to all kinds of vibrations outdoors. So in this second experiment, we played back vibrations caused by a gentle wind on the leaves and also vibrations from a common insect in the plant's habitat, a treehopper. And neither of those vibrations stimulated the chemical defense.
What plant was it that you used?
We started with Arabidopsis thaliana, which is the lab rat of the plant world. It's very useful to us because it has a completely sequenced genome and a lot of other genetic resources.
And what do we call it in English?
Thalecress.
It's a kind of cress.
Yeah, mustard. It's related to the watercress, you know, we love to eat. And that those mustard oils are what make the watercress tasty to us.
Heidi Apple, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Robert. It's been my pleasure.
Heidi Apple is a senior research scientist in the Bond Life Sciences Center at the University of Missouri. She spoke to us about the study that she and Rex Cocroft have published showing that plants respond to insects chewing. It was published last week in the journal Ecologia.